All right, folks, I think we're going to get started. Folks want to have a seat, get comfortable. In the back, I will mention some resources in terms of my business card, brochures for Choices Counseling and Consulting, as well as my colleague and the director of Choices and Tigris, Arlene Lev. She just recently published a book, Families in Transition. And so there's some information about her book back there as well. So I'm happy to be an ongoing resource, so feel free to reach out to me as needed. There's also a sheet with some references as well as some resources on that, which you may or may not be familiar with. All right. So we're going to go until about 4:45. We're in the long stretch. We're at the back end of things. It's after lunch. I always get a little sleepy. I'm a little sleepy myself. So hang in there with me. But again, my name is AC Mercer. I'm with Choices Counseling Consulting, as well as the Training Institute for Gender, Relationships, Identity, and Sexuality. And we've been having technology issues, but maybe it'll work now. Okay. And I just wanted to mention, I didn't mention it earlier, in terms of Tigris, part of the work that I also do is policy creation and implementation, especially in school settings, in terms of how to be more culturally competent and supportive of students especially. But I also work with other agencies, mental health facilities, medical facilities, et cetera, in terms of implementing more accommodating and supportive policies, especially for folks that are trans or non-binary. Okay, so we're just going to jump right into things. Stop me at any point if I'm stuttering, mumbling, you have no idea what I just said, need me to repeat myself, or if you just have a question. Okay, so hopefully this will be pretty painless and we can kind of move through things. How many folks feel like they've had a lot of training in terms of work around working with trans folks? Okay, so a fair amount. Okay, so hopefully I'll live up to your standards. I'm not sure, I guess we'll see. Okay, all right. So in terms of gender development, it's a part of human development. I mean, it's a natural part of our growth as individuals, right? So it involves growth, maintenance, and regulation. It's normal for there to be variables, right? So variable identities, etc. It's normal, right? So it's based on interaction of biological traits, developmental influences, and environmental conditions. So obviously it's genetics, environment, individual choices, etc. So just as a sort of general starting place, so that we're all kind of on the same page. So Pollock provides some of these stages of gender identity development, which you may or may not ascribe to. And it's important to notice, I think I have it up there, but it's important to note that people go in and out of these stages in different levels, at different ways. So there's a growing sense of gender. Obviously that's impacted by school and puberty, sexuality, exposure to diverse gender options, etc. There's recognition of transgender and non-binary identity. So obviously a young person recognizing and experiencing their gender identity differently with their birth gender or sex assigned or sex assumed at birth. And then social adjustment, right? So that comes later on when folks become more comfortable with themselves, they're able to adjust to their identity and others are accepting and supportive. All right. And so this is the same model here. Again, it's by Pollock. Just in terms of the way these things happen, et cetera. For those of you who are visual, I'm not especially, so this isn't my model that I, it doesn't, not my take on things. So anyway, so in terms of trans and gender diverse youth, it's an emerging population, right? Folks are coming out younger and younger, and I think the reason for this is because we're having more discourse. We're finally having conversation around gender identity and non-binary identities and different ways of existing. Right, conversation is finally happening, and so people are feeling safer and safer to come out. Obviously, this is affected by political climates, et cetera, so we have to be mindful of that and how that influences our clients. But ultimately, when it comes to youth, folks are coming out younger and younger. There's unique issues with working with kids and folks who are gender diverse, and there's little research. We're growing in terms of research, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I have some information for you that might be helpful. But we actually have more information on adolescents versus small children, but that's changing. We do have some folks in the field that are doing some great work that we'll talk about. How many folks are familiar with WPATH? Okay, so this is a great resource, in my opinion, for folks to know about, right? So WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. It's WPATH.org. Basically, they have what are called the standards of care. We're on version 7 right now. They're in the process of working on version 8. When that's due to come out, I don't know just yet, but something to be looking for. Basically, WPATH provides, within these standards of care, guidelines on working with youth, adolescents, you know, children, as well as adults. So I think it's great in terms of a starting point, in terms of information, there's research, et cetera, as well as guidelines, like I mentioned. So WPATH basically says, being transsexual, which I think is an outdated term, but obviously that language, transgender or gender nonconforming is a matter of diversity, not pathology. It's not a disease or disorder. And it's a dis-ease. So there's a discomfort that exists, but it's not a disease. Can obviously, as we've seen most often with clients, it can cause extreme discomfort, anxiety, depression, and other symptoms. And the DSM-5 obviously reflects this as well. So gender dysphoria, we're going to get to that right now. Yep. So in terms of gender dysphoria, it refers to the discomfort or distress that's caused by a discrepancy between a person's gender identity and that person's sex assigned at birth, or sex assumed at birth. I think it's a matter of diversity, but in terms of, so when we're talking about trans identity, we're talking about identity. There's no pathology, there's no diagnosis involved in that. When we're talking about gender dysphoria, that's what we're treating. We're not treating identity, we're treating the discomfort, this dysphoria that people experience. When there's a disconnect between their bodies at times and their gender identity. Does that make sense for you? As much as it can? Okay. All right. Everybody with me so far? Folks pretty much have heard of gender dysphoria and know about gender dysphoria. So obviously, it's also in the DSM. The guidelines and criteria is outlined. It's very accessible, et cetera. I want to be really clear, though, when we're talking about gender dysphoria, not all trans and non-binary people experience gender dysphoria. That's something that's critical for folks to know. It's not a requirement in terms of being transgender. It may be an aspect of somebody's experience, but not of all trans and non-binary folks. Okay, some people are very comfortable with their bodies and identify as transgender or non-binary. Okay, so with me on that? All right. So in terms of assessment and evaluation, and I always get a little, you know, because when we talk about assessment, the way I look at it, assess in Latin, or is it Greek? It's either Greek or Latin, forgive me, I can't remember. Assess means to sit with, right? So this is the way that I look at it. When people are coming to me with gender dysphoria and are looking for medical intervention or support, I'm looking at collaborating with them, sitting with them, right? Not sitting with my clipboard saying, yes, you're this, no, you're not. It's more of collaborating. So I'm not going to get into too much of in terms of evaluation, but for resources just to know about, I mentioned the standards of care. There's the questionnaire by Dara Hoffman, provides some questions and information of ways to pose different conversations with clients. So I think these are some great resources for you to know about. It is listed in your packet, I think, on the first set of resources that were provided earlier. So just to know about those, just in terms of questions, et cetera. Because I think a lot of people sometimes don't exactly know where to begin with folks, or what to talk about, or how to go into a gender history, et cetera. So these are some resources that are helpful. So what are the concerns? Oftentimes I hear that these are young people, they're too young to know their gender identity, that it's just a phase. We're giving medicine to young people, we're talking about surgeries with young people. There's a lot of concern and heightened issue and tensions over this, especially when we talk about youth. The question is, why do we assume everyone else, that cis people, know their identity? Right? I mean, it's a question just worth sort of sitting with and thinking. Right? We don't when they're young. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's an interesting point of view. Sure. And so, what we know is that medications are relatively safe, right, for youth. And so in terms of pregnancy, so I think about this, when we talk about concerns over, you know, should they transition, should they not, should they have medical interventions, they're so young, how do we make this decision? I think about the example of pregnancy. So imagine yourself, if you have or have not, just imagine, you're working with a teen who's pregnant. As I see it, there's three options. You can work with them to either decide to have the child and raise it themselves at the age of, say, 13. Okay, that's one option. They can choose to have an abortion, or they can choose to have the child and give the child up for adoption. Which of those choices is the best option? Which is the right decision? Child's 13. Depends on the child. Depends on resources. There isn't necessarily a right answer. Any other thoughts? I think of that and sort of parallel it to issues around gender. People are looking for right answers, and especially parents. We're going to talk about that. I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer. What we know is the research tells us that supporting youth makes for better outcomes, and we'll talk more about that. That's what we know for sure, and that's what we should be expressing to families when we're working with youth that are trans or non-binary and are experiencing gender dysphoria. Okay? So again, no decision, I'll get to you one moment. No decision is an easy decision. There's a lot to consider. There's a lot of different factors. But again, I don't know if there's a right or wrong. I think there's a right and wrong between supporting your child or not. But sometimes it's a matter of psychoeducation and additional resources. Did you have something?
Yeah, please.
So I work with the parents of trans youth all the time around their decision making around puberty blockers and hormones. And I was really affected 2 years ago when I went to a Fenway conference where they had a physician from GEMS, which is a gender identity program in Boston for youth. And this physician said that we cannot say that puberty blockers are. There are no longitudinal studies on the long-term effects of puberty blockers given to children. And so we're not really sure that puberty blockers are safe. So I'm just wondering what you would say about that.
No, and I think that's the hard part, is that we don't have that information. We don't have the longitudinal studies, as you've mentioned. I think that's up and coming. You know, what I will say is that for youth with precocious puberty, pubertal blockers have been used and used successfully and in a healthy and safe manner. And so I think basically we're using them for trans and non-binary folks in the same way with that understanding. I do agree. I think there needs to be more studies. There needs to be more information. And I don't know if folks saw this, but in the news and on the internet, there's been this story about puberty blockers and how many people are dying from being on puberty blockers. I don't know if folks have heard about that. I can't remember who it was published by, forgive me. So just sort of a synopsis of it. Basically, they're going based off of folks that have prostate cancer that are taking these pubertal blockers and basing that information and addressing it and stating it as if it's youth and children. Right, so it's misinformation that's being circulated. So I think that's important to know about, just because parents especially can see this on the internet and get confused, get concerned, etc. But to your point, I definitely agree that we need more information, we need more research, and I think in time we're going to have that. I do. And we also know the effects of children that have severe gender dysphoria and going into puberty and how traumatic that can be. And so on some level, similar to the pregnancy example, there's different sort of consequences and outcomes with each choice, right? And so it's weighing and balancing those. So part of it is acknowledging concerns, right? So it's obviously an evolving field, right? It's a very controversial topic, right, overall. And again, data is emerging slowly. I mentioned already that there's more information on adolescents versus young kids. Identity and sexuality are always in flux with children and youth. It's really important that we understand that, and a lot of the work that we're doing with families is how to help them remain flexible, right, around identity. So Christina Olson, this is some wonderful research. Have folks heard of Christina Olson by chance? No. Well, I encourage you to look into her research and information. I have a video clip that we'll watch. But basically what Christina Olson has found in the research she's doing, she's studying small children, that basically she's finding that kids that are gender non-binary, identify as transgender, have a clear understanding of their gender expression as compared with cisgender peers. Okay. When they're allowed to be socialized and live and be their authentic selves. Right. So socially transitioned trans children supported by their families exhibit far less psychopathology than previously reported among closeted and unsupported youth. Right. So this is important information. And so I have a video. It's about 9 minutes. So if folks can hang in there and not fall asleep, I think it's helpful and interesting.
NewsHour special correspondent Jackie Judd has our story of doctors and families living through these discoveries.
8-year-old Skylar Kelly is hoping for a career in the major leagues and enjoys the privileges of being big brother to 4-year-old Luke. It is not how life started for Skylar.
I can totally see, you know, sitting on the hospital bed and, you know, a days of a long labor and someone saying like, oh, you know, what a sweet little girl.
At a remarkably early age, Skylar, who lives in Seattle, began to let his parents know that what he looked like on the outside, a girl, is not how he felt on the inside.
When people tried to brush my hair, I would try to push the brush away and I'd cry and scream and it was hard in the mornings to even get ready.
Did you also have a fight over clothing, what to wear, what kind of clothes to wear?
Well, I was pretty much allowed to wear what I wanted except on school pictures. I had to wear a dress, and I hated it.
So did you ever smile in those school pictures, or?
I smiled, but.
But inside?
I did not like it inside.
The why of Skylar's gender identity isn't fully understood. The long-held and now controversial medical view links being transgender to a mental disorder or emotional distress. However, new science is emerging, pointing to a complex set of factors.
If Jazz said I'm a boy, then that would be in the top category.
At the University of Washington, psychology professor Christina Olson investigates the origins of being transgender.
Your biology determines a lot of your psychology, and I think that's kind of where the feeling is right now, that there are probably biological contributors that make a big contribution towards our sense of gender identity, which is, you know, psychologically how we feel. Are we male or female or something else, something in between, neither?
Ma'am, how are you doing today?
How are you?
Good to see you.
Endocrinologist Joshua Safer at Boston University treats hundreds of adult transgender patients and is a leader in the field. He firmly believes gender identity is hardwired in all of us.
In most people, chromosomes, body parts, gender identity align. So somebody with male chromosomes, somebody with male body parts is going to have male gender identity. That is the usual circumstance. All of these are independently controlled biologically, and therefore it is no surprise that in a given subset of the population, one part is not aligned, that whatever genes are controlling that happen to be different for that individual, and that's what's happening with transgender individuals.
Dr. Safer conducted the most extensive review to date of existing studies tying gender identity to biological factors. The most persuasive evidence he found was in experiments done over the past half century on people born with the male XY chromosomes, but with the rare condition of ambiguous genitalia. Soon after birth, they were surgically given female genitalia and then raised as girls.
These kids were dressed in pink and given dresses and dolls and given estrogen when they hit puberty so that they had appropriate breast development and such. So we're talking about a pretty extreme approach that if any approach was going to work, it should have worked. But what happened instead is the majority of these kids, if you query, say that they have male gender identity despite that very, very extreme program.
The conclusion, according to Dr. Safer, is that gender identity cannot be manipulated or taught. A second set of data he reviewed involved the anatomy of the brain. Postmortem testing of women and males at birth who transitioned to females found certain regions to be strikingly similar, though Dr. Safer says more research is needed to determine if those regions are linked to gender identity. At this lab at the University of Washington in Seattle, a unique long-term study is underway of transgender children, children as young as 3 years of age. With the support of their families, they have transitioned from the gender of their birth to what's called their expressed gender.
My turn.
Skylar's turn.
Skylar, along with several dozen other kids, both transgender and not, went through a battery of tests in the first phase of the study to pinpoint how they see themselves.
Okay. All ready to go?
Yes.
Ready, go.
This very quick picture and word association called IAT, or implicit association test, is intended to take a true measure of the strength of a child's identity.
If there is a kid who at birth, the doctor said this kid is a girl, but later came to identify as a boy, and that kid is, you know, living as a boy today, that kid will show the same results on the IAT as any other boy and looks nothing like, say, his sister or another random girl that we just pulled off the street.
Dr. Olson leads the study team.
So this suggests that, you know, this isn't just a thing a kid is saying or pretending to be. This doesn't seem to be, you know, a kid being playful or being ornery. This is really, truly how the child seems to identify themselves at this age.
Dr. Olson's research cuts to the core of the dilemma parents of transgender children face. How to know if this is real.
I guess my concerns as it evolved and we were not at the stage of, you know, him being an affirmed male, my concerns are we jumping the gun? And then it just wasn't comfortable with that whole thing.
Many people struggle with the same thing and believe transgender children are just going through a phase. Dr. Olson says in 2 years of following the same group of youngsters, none has reverted to their gender at birth. Still, she encounters deep skepticism.
We see a lot of people saying things like, you know, my child thought that they were a dinosaur when they were four, but I didn't, you know, let them live as a dinosaur, and they didn't really think they were a dinosaur. These are kids who are saying, this is who I am a girl, or I am a boy.
The Kellys came to certainty one night when Skylar was about six, and there was no denying what their child was trying to tell them.
I remember, God, this one awful night, I can still picture us upstairs, and Skylar was just having like a meltdown over nothing. I mean, but just a heartbreaking meltdown, like the kind you can tell the difference between a tantrum and I am just so emotionally unhappy. And Josh and I both just finally saying, like, what is it? Is there something that you're not telling us? And I said, do you want to whisper it to us? And he whispered and said, I want to start wearing boys' underwear.
And that is when Skylar transitioned, entering first grade as the person he knew himself to be.
And then what do you say?
Dr. Olson now has about 100 transgender children in the study, and she hopes to follow them into adolescence and adulthood, and that by learning more, the too common trajectory of a transgender person's life can be changed.
We all look at the news and we see those terrible statistics about what life is like for transgender adults. 41% of transgender adults attempt suicide. They have extremely high rates of unemployment and discrimination, violence. And what I want to know is, how do we change that? Is there a decision that could be made in a child's life and instead put them on a path that's more like the other kids that they go to school with and are in their families, where, you know, they have just as good a chance as anyone else.
Of all these words, which words would you choose to describe yourself? Happy, angry, proud, sad? Which words?
Happy, proud.
Happy, proud? Why happy, proud?
Because I'm happy now that I get to live how I want, and I'm proud because my parents understood it, and they're great.
He's super well adjusted, very happy.
He's braver than I've ever felt. And I hope that he can keep that and that the world doesn't break him of that.
The Kellys say the emerging science of gender identity is less important to them than their child finding acceptance and support. They know it may not be an easy life for Skylar, but it will be an authentic one. For the NewsHour, this is Jackie Judd in Seattle.
Reactions, thoughts? Do we have reactions to that?
I felt hurt watching this by the way that things got reduced to a biological and kind of a non-genderqueer, a binary way of thinking about things. And so for me, I really don't care what chromosome Skylar has because clearly he's able to express. I mean, I started tearing up because having a kid who's three, hearing him express himself so clearly and tell his parents so clearly what he wanted really blows me away. And what feels so hurtful in how some of the scientists were talking about it is, why do we have to find a biological answer for this when someone can tell us what they need? So I think that was sort of...
So I agree totally. That's what I was going to talk about. So Christina Olson is doing an amazing service giving us this data about cross-gender identifying kids, but she's only looking at cross-gender identifying kids. She's not looking at non-binary kids. And I don't know that that's an accident, because I think the research that gets funded is on what we think of stereotypically as what is trans, you know, and that's cross-gender identifying. But more and more it's not. And also the work, and I resent the quest for a biological basis to give being trans legitimacy, because I think we can give it legitimacy without the biological basis. And also the world is changing. It's a moving target, and some kids are growing up seeing that there's a non-binary option, seeing that they don't have to identify as the other gender in order to feel like they're authentic.
I think to your point, I think that was a great example. So gender expression is obviously clothing, accessories, mannerisms, things of that nature. So in terms of gender expression, that's how we oftentimes authenticate us. I mean, honestly, if we could break down all barriers, if we could break down all boxes, I would love that. That's why I was hoping we'd get to do that exercise earlier. But I think it's important to understand that... part of the issue is a larger systemic societal issue that's at play here. And so, yes, to your point, we're talking about gender expression. We're talking about these boxes. And especially these kids are definitely kids that are within the gender binary. So even a transgender binary, right? And so I appreciate this conversation and was hoping to evoke this kind of conversation because it does. It is void of folks that are non-binary. And I think we are moving in that direction where there's more gender fluidity and openness around gender.
I have a mic.
Where are you?
Oh, yes. I have the mic. I'm going to use it. I have the mic. I'm going to say something that I hope is not offensive. I'm 75 years old. I'm cisgender, 75-year-old woman. And I think we live in a world where what matters to me even more than differentiating people is finding connection and oneness. And I think when I see something like that, people are trying to understand people who this is very new for. I think many people who are kind-hearted and who want to be open and want to honor people and how they want to be also need to be brought into the conversation. They need their feelings also need to be considered. People need to understand that it's hard if you're a grandma or, you know, if you've lived your entire life with certain assumptions that there needs to be a bigger, larger, kinder conversation that includes everybody, and that the more we fail to do that and the more that we see these see this as something that separates people, the more pain it's going to cause for everybody. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Go on, come back to you. Sorry.
I just really wanted to say that what I noticed from this, I think that made the biggest difference in Skylar's life was the parents listening and being supportive. And that's made, that's what he said at the end. So I felt like that was the biggest thing that struck me, not more than the research.
Exactly.
Thank you. I appreciate this. I'm just noticing my own anxiety and some anger coming up. But I want to hold the need for respectful, kind, inclusive discourse and center marginalized voices and lift up the marginalized voices. And so I don't have the answer for how to do that, especially as a cis person. Definitely don't have the answer for that. But what I'm just noticing in myself is how do we as clinicians collectively talk about these things that are hard and not further marginalize oppressed voices?
So I just wanted to say I identify as a cis female, and there are not every clinician in here identifies as either binary, cis, or trans. And so in having this conversation, I also just wanted to kind of name the fact that the way we can talk about this, and I don't have a solution for it, but sometimes the way we can express our anxiety or our not knowing or our kind of places of growth, areas of growth, can also kind of be harmful when we get into like our fear and our anxiety. And I notice a lot of reactivity, especially like when it comes to talking about children and kind of gender and things happening with children. And so I just kind of want to name that, like, everyone's a learner until they learn. And I can appreciate that people feel like experience or age or location can impact that. And I also want to hold that sometimes there's internal work and sometimes there's external work to be done. And whether it should be done in a shared space or in our own space or in a smaller space, I think should also just maybe be a consideration for those people who are not kind of, for who might feel like really kind of raw, actually, after a whole day of this.
Is there more? Did somebody over here have something?
One more here.
Oh.
Hi. I work at Brightside, and we're working with a lot of young children, and currently I have an 8-year-old who is born female and believes that get the pronouns right, that she is a, oh my God, now I'm confused myself. He is born male and believes that she is a female. So, and the parents, because of the puberty, want to start the child on puberty drugs and is making sure that the child feels comfortable in dressing and acting in the sex that they feel that they want to be. And so, you know, we're seeing more and more of this. And I think, you know, we try to be very supportive, both with the parents as well with the kids. So I just wanted to bring that up.
I just wanted to speak to the, we ask so many questions. I have a four-year-old who appears to be a cisgender girl. And I think when we talk about children, we forget how much we knew about ourselves. And these kids are no different. So if you think about what it was like to be forced to wear something that didn't fit with how you saw yourself, which I think has probably happened to all of us, or how old you were when you knew whose hand you wanted to hold. We knew this stuff. We, and those of us who are cisgender and maybe straight identified, didn't notice because it was the same as what everyone expected of us. So, you know, just to hold that and to take a minute to think about what you know of yourself as a little one, like, we knew, and these kids also know.
I agree but disagree, because I think that there are, I would resist that there's going to be one trans youth narrative that's like they knew as far back as they could remember that they wanted to be the so-called opposite gender. I see kids coming out as trans and non-binary and cross-gender identifying at all different ages, and adults too. And so I just want to really make room for there being multiple paths in transit.
It's more just that cis folks have an experience of like understanding themselves to have a gender identity. We just tend to be less aware of it. I'm not suggesting that kids have to know when they're little to be really, really trans, just to be clear.
It's a rich conversation. I appreciate this. Other thoughts?
No, just to say, like, coming back to the piece about the video, and like the value of this research, because I had a similar reaction with non-binary pieces, but I also think something I struggle with in my own practice around diagnosis and writing letters and all of these pieces of like that feel like gatekeeping for a lot of the folks that I work with. At the same time, a lot of those things actually have allowed people to access services. So like the WPATH organization has a lot of limitations in terms of its social justice work, but at the same time really paved the path to try to help trans folks access care over the years. And so I feel really torn about it, and it's a struggle. Like the ICD is about to switch gender dysphoria possibly into a medical diagnosis instead of a psychological diagnosis, and that's, we're not really quite sure how that's going to affect things. And so part of me feels like this research is super, super crucial, even if that's the only research we can get funding for, because I want people to still be able to access that care. And also I'm worried about what happens when we might eventually, maybe hopefully someday, probably not, but eventually get to the point where people can express their genders in whatever ways they want and not have everyone assume what their gender is based on how they look or how they act. And I don't think we're going to get there anytime soon, but I'm scared for when that day comes, because I worry that people won't be able to access care medically if the insurances get wind of the fact that we're saying, oh, well, whatever, everybody gets to be whatever they want, not like this is actually medically necessary because this person might die by suicide if we don't offer this to them. So I, you know, it's a struggle for me too to figure that out.
That's a great point. Absolutely. Anyone else? Other thoughts? I mean, I think it speaks to the complexity around this, and that there's no one answer. Right? I mean, that's the hard part, is wouldn't we all like there just to be a guidebook and for us to know exactly how to behave, how to do this, how to respond, and how to help and support everybody in the best possible way. There's no one clear path or one clear answer. So I'm going to try and do this and not replay the video. So ultimately, when we talk about young folks, we're talking about social transition. Oftentimes, I mean, there's no diagnosis around social transition. This is supporting a family and helping them to fully actualize their child, right? And so ultimately, we're talking about insistence, consistence, and persistence. And I want to be clear that not all of these trajectories are the same for all kids. I want to be really clear about that. So social transition is just that. There's no medical intervention, right? The child can wear whatever clothing they want. We talked about gender expression. They can express themselves however they feel most comfortable. They can cut their hair any way they want. Child can use different or more gendered name if they want. Again, going back to, there are some individuals that are trans or non-binary that do on some level want to present in a more gendered way. Maybe not non-binary, let me excuse myself. But in terms of trans, I think there are folks, like I mentioned earlier, that are within a binary, and it's supporting those folks as well. So using a different name, choosing their pronouns, and respecting their pronouns, and that's it. And it's reversible. I mean, and ultimately, that's what we're supporting families through. And I think it takes a lot of resources around this because we're working with school systems, we're working with communities, we're working with the family, we're working with siblings. There's a lot of different aspects that influence social transition and how we support folks through that. There is criteria. So basically, social transition before puberty, it's thought of as a complex process for some, right? So necessity, these are the questions that we want to be asking when we're supporting families. Is it crucial to the child, and has it been? How is this showing up for this kid? How are they presenting? How are they talking about their gender? What are they saying that they need? Right? Safety, is the environment, home, school, and neighborhood, is it safe? What would make it safer for them to fully actualize themselves and to go through a social transition to where they're presenting themselves as they feel most comfortable? And does it require training? For example, I go into schools oftentimes and give educational trainings. I talk about policy implementation and making change to be more accommodating and supportive of youth, or move. I mean, historically, there's a lot of folks that may have uprooted their lives and moved elsewhere. And historically, that's sort of this narrative that folks had. There are still some families that feel that need, depending on their neighborhood, depending on where their geographic location is. There are some issues that it's unsafe, and they actually feel the need where they have to uproot their lives and move to a different school district, move to a different state. I've actually had families that I've worked with that have chosen to do that, right? And so it's supporting people if they feel that that is the safest and best decision. It's really exploring that, and what is that about, and what are their options? Right, and readiness. Is the family ready? Is the community ready? Is there enough support for the child and the parents? Flexibility. This, again, I speak to this all the time. Flexibility. Are parents willing to see it as experimental, potentially? Right? Are they committed to it and diving in head first while also remaining flexible and understanding that it can change and shift and that's okay? That's the part that we have to be okay with, is that it's okay to have fluctuating gender identities. Right, gender identity does not have to be fixed. For some people, it absolutely is, but not for everybody. So the alternative view, maybe it's not such a big deal. So is social transition a big deal? What are people's thoughts? Shouldn't have to be. Okay.
I think it both is and isn't a big deal. It's not a big deal in the sense that, you know, if that's who the child is or who the person is, then they should just kind of go with the flow. But it is a big deal in the sense that it changes expectations and perceptions around them, and having people readjust to that change is a big deal.
Thank you.
A big deal. So I think something that I've been considering lately is that for the youth that I work with who aren't able to socially transition safely or even choose not to, that idea that doesn't bear on the validity of their identity, right? So, like, is it such a big deal in the context of determining, you know, is a kid really trans? Are they really non-binary? And I know that's not the exact question you have, but I just want to offer that because I think a lot of times we say, you know, oh, once, you know, they start going by she, her pronouns, then they'll be a girl, and like this person's deeply held and real sense of who they are is not necessarily tied to that social transition. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that came up for me is one of the things that you mentioned, this is so brief, and I imagine you'd agree with it, but just in like non-binary people having binary gendered presentations at times, it makes me think of particularly some of the trans feminine non-binary folks that I work with, how that identity can be seen as less valid if you are presenting in like more feminine ways. So if you haven't socially transitioned in a way that's perfectly androgynous, like you are not non-binary enough. And that was something I just wanted to offer. Like in that aspect, it seems very like that social transition and the way you present yourself, it is weighted so heavily, right? So there's all these ways that it is and isn't such a big deal. It's so interesting. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
I got you on this one.
Hi. I think what came up for me as I was looking at this list was just thinking about, well, how essential are all these things even before your child potentially says anything about their gender identity? And I'm just thinking about that Winnicott quote, like, play is the space where the child discovers the self. And if we don't create space for children to play with everything about themselves, including their gender identity, then how can they discover it? And so I think I think safety, all these things feel essential, even before maybe there's a statement of, I am X, you know? So yeah, it feels like, yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal, even if there's not a quote unquote transition that's occurring. It would be a big deal for a kid that might end up identifying as cis, just to have that space to kind of explore what and play with what all of these things mean to them.
I was just looking at the list here, and I was thinking about readiness and whether anybody, any family is really completely ready, and how as a clinician you support them through that leap of the unknown. And that counters with the flexibility, because parents often want to know this is the right thing. So asking them that they're ready for a lot of parents means that it's set, it's done. Once they socially transition, then that's the path, period, the end. And so those two, one, readiness is hard to define, and readiness sometimes depends on the family feeling like it's not flexible when that's actually what the kid may need.
Excuse me, thank you. Anything else? Okay. All right. So prepubertal children, right? So obviously we're letting them explore, we're letting them be. Right? Psychotherapy, if needed, if they're struggling with their identity, they're needing to talk it out. Not all kids have that experience, okay? Groups, camps, there's Camp Aeronautic. I don't know if folks are familiar with that. Camp Aeronautic is a great camp. Are there other camps that people are familiar with? That's the one that I'm most familiar with. I think it might be dependent on area, but that's the one. I think there's one located on the East Coast and the West Coast. Nick Teich started Camp Aeronautic, and it's for trans non-binary kids that are questioning their gender identity, etc.
Camp Aeronautic T-I-Q, and it's under the umbrella of Harbor Camps, which I think is like Harbor with a U, which might be easier for folks to find because they do have a few other camps with the intention of making spaces for kids. So, yeah.
And in addition to the camps, they also have family days, so where parents, caregivers can go and participate and be around not only other children, but also other families. So it's a really great resource to know about. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. My spelling is not my strength by any means whatsoever. Right, again, I mentioned social transition for some. So building supportive families, networks, and schools. Recognition that this might be a time of gender fluidity. And making appropriate medical contacts if needed. Right? Yes?
I
Thank you. How do you recommend handling it when there's the kind of gatekeeping function of psychotherapy, which might be so-and-so needs to be in therapy and have a letter to access puberty blockers or eventually kind of hormones for kids, but kind of like there's not the necessarily like the dysphoria piece that that child is experiencing in kind of like a diagnosable way, or psychotherapy is really not kind of indicated because there's not really psychopathology around it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering kind of like how you would hold those two things.
So ultimately, I kind of lean into the conversation around gatekeeping, and the way I see it, and similar to what you had said, is around sort of the importance or the influence of insurance. And sometimes, for me, I see it as a means to an end. So if I need to meet this criteria or provide this letter, I'm sort of appeasing, unfortunately, you know, insurance companies so that this child, this adult, whoever, can have their needs met. But I'm ultimately leaning into the conversations about gatekeeping, about, you know, the limitations with our systems, the limitations with society at large. I mean, these are all questions and conversations that I think are pertinent to the clinical space and have to be brought in the room. I mean, I think that's the part of the work. Again, we're not sitting there with a clipboard. Yes, you're trans. No, you're not. Yes, part of it is that collaborative. You're sitting with them, moving through it together. I don't know if that answered your question. Okay. Puberty, for some, can be a horrific experience, right? So transgender children develop increased gender dysphoria as they near and enter puberty. Again, this is not all transgender children, but there are some that have this experience, okay? So anatomical dysmorphia, and we need to differentiate from social condemnation of atypical gender expression or gender diversity, right? For gender nonconforming youth, as well as issues of emerging sexual orientation. There can be some youth that are confused, that don't understand, that don't know the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity. So psychoeducation is a huge part of the work that each of us need to be participating in, so that we're not only educating the youth, but also their families, right? I run a group for parents and caregivers, and I'm consistently having to talk about the difference between sex and gender identity, and having to explain these, and gender expression, and how not all of them line up nice and neat. And I just constantly have parents, you know, I don't understand, you know, my child was, you know, assigned female, and transitioned, is on testosterone now, you know, but wears dresses, and I just don't understand, and if you wanted to be a boy, why aren't you acting like a boy? You know, and I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that parents get stuck because we're having to relearn. That's part of the work, and that's why this is so difficult right now, because all of us, given our societal, you know, context, et cetera, we are having to unlearn so much of this. Whereas I think youth coming up and younger folks are really seeing fluidity and living that and understanding it in a different way than we have access to. I think, so again, that unlearning and relearning piece is really critical. So a lot of that work is with families.
Female at birth and is trans male, but does not experience gender dysphoria. And I'm just curious if you could maybe differentiate how that occurs alongside other people who do have gender dysphoria. I'm just a little confused, and I've been a little squeamish to just directly ask my client. So,
can you just repeat that one? I think I missed something.
Yeah, so they are
assigned female.
Assigned female, identify as trans male.
Trans male.
And doesn't experience gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little confused about how that occurs.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that occurs.
Or how that exists, or how that's different than someone who does experience gender dysphoria. I'm just trying to understand the psychology and the experience of those two different scenarios.
Do you have a thought? I see
a
quick hand here.
I think we have to break down dysphoria into social dysphoria and body dysphoria. So I don't know if you're saying that your client doesn't feel body dysphoria. So your client might not feel body dysphoria, but might have a trans male gender identity and wants to be seen socially as a trans male, but is totally fine with his, her, or their body.
That's great. Is that helping with your question?
The piece that gets additionally complicated is that, especially with folks who are like non-binary, that dysphoria can actually wax and wane. It can, you know, I've had people say like, I wish I just had my chest attached to a pair of hangers that I could like take it off some days and then wear it other days. And so sometimes that actually makes it a little more complicated as well, but really just trusting somebody's experience that sometimes it is an internal sense of dysphoria, but then other times it's coming from these different social pieces or how that person feels on a certain morning or like how they're like, I've had people talk about how like how their hair looks that day leads to increases or decreases in dysphoria. Certain times of the month hormonally lead to shifts in that. So it really, that's, I think, the trickier part, too, is that it really does vary.
It's excellent.
I wanted to ask you a question about talking with dysphoria, especially with prepubescent children. Very often I have young people come into the office and they're so savvy. They've done their internet research. They know dysphoria up and down. Sometimes I, you know, whether they have it or not, they know the lingo. And then sometimes I have folks who come into my office and for a myriad of reasons, they aren't familiar with this. And there's a lot of psychoeducation that goes into the dysphoria piece to help them understand how this is or isn't affecting their life, right? And I get really tripped up with younger kiddos, and I, especially prepubescent, I'm not really using the word dysphoria when I'm trying to like get an understanding of how they feel in their bodies. But yeah, I think it's a growth area for me to do evaluation around dysphoria with these younger kiddos. And I was just wondering if you had any tips about like what language we use to help these kiddos understand themselves and do these evaluations.
I'd actually like to sort of poll the audience. Like, I'd like to get feedback. I feel like folks are giving really, I feel there's strength in hearing from other colleagues. So I'd love to hear what folks are using, what folks are doing in response to this question. Do we not have an answer? Do folks not have an answer in terms of, I don't know that I have a perfect answer either. I think part of it is sort of being along for the journey with them, and we provide them the education and we talk about bodies as best we can. I think it's, I don't have a clear answer. You know, I think, what's that? You know, so I guess I just want to validate the fact that I think all of us are sort of in this together and we're sort of learning and trying to figure this out as we go.
Would also use tools that you would use in other kinds of child therapy, like, you know, art and play and imaginative play to understand how they feel about their bodies.
Right.
And I also think taking on the advocacy role, it's really important for us to do work in schools, like you do, I do, to develop gender diversity curriculum so that all kids are raised with those possibilities and that language.
That's great. I don't know why I didn't think of that, but thank you. I do a lot of draw therapy, you know, with kids drawing, you know, dolls, dress up, things like that, in terms of how kids relate to the dolls that they're dressing, you know, the way that they're drawing themselves, how they can potentially, you know, when you get older, how do you see yourself? I mean, that's a hard question, I think, for any of us, you know, but it's... you know, an approach to it. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Okay, we're definitely in the home stretch here. So, okay. So fertility is a conversation, you know, that needs to happen, especially when we're talking about hormones, puberty blockers, and then hormones. It's a conversation I have with not only the youth, depending on their age, but also the family. Because this is a huge point of tension, I think, especially for parents and caregivers. There's a lot of tension that comes up around this. Because I think there's a, and we'll talk about this, a loss of expectations. You know, how is my child going to have children? How are they going to, you know, I wanted to be a grandparent, and they have all these sort of dreams and aspirations for their children, and how that affects them. You know, so fertility is a crucial part of conversation with families when we're talking about this. And again, we need more studies around this. We're very limited in that regard. But it's important that we're discussing these things and that we're working with folks. The unfortunate thing is that, especially for folks that were assumed to be female, that are going on testosterone or pursuing hormones, you know, the process of extracting eggs, harvesting eggs, and freezing them and maintaining them is very expensive, it's very invasive, et cetera. And most of the families that I work with are not able to afford this, insurance doesn't cover it, et cetera. I think in the 10 years I've been doing this, I've had one person that's been able to, and this is an adult person, who was able to preserve their fertility in terms of harvesting eggs and such, and that's because they got a loan from grandparents that they're having to pay back. So there's limited options, unfortunately. So these are sometimes really big decisions that folks are having to make at very young ages. And I think that's also a huge point of tension for families. I'm just going to keep going. So generally speaking, there's three potential outcomes, ultimately. Well, let me go back this way. So I guess I will go back to this. So gender nonconforming, gender diverse, gender expansive children, ultimately, the outcomes could potentially be, so they become transgender adolescents or genderqueer youth, non-binary. They have different sexual orientations. Maybe it's a reflection of, you know, their gay, lesbian identity, et cetera. Or they grow up to be cisgender and heterosexual. You know, these are potential outcomes. From gender nonconformity, specifically, as youth are aging. So these are the different potential outcomes. Just for the sake of time, I'm going to keep going just because... The thing is that we can't know the outcome for any child. And I think that's part of what makes this work difficult, is because there's a lot of gray areas. And I think as gender continues to expand and this continuum, you know, continues to grow, there's going to be more and more conversation around this. I actually think it's going to become even more complex because there's different types of bodies. There's different ways that people relate to their bodies. I think it's only going to become just more complex.
Does the curve move any more towards certainty as the child's age increases, like working with someone who's 8 versus 12 versus 16?
So in my experience, the closer to puberty that folks get, especially in adolescence, when folks hit puberty or experience puberty, I have seen, at least in the folks that I've worked with, that there's a consistency in terms of their gender identity, in terms of trans identity. So especially from puberty, folks are close to puberty or nearing puberty or in puberty and are identifying as transgender. I've seen that there's been, at least with my clientele, there's been a consistent trajectory that they have gone on to continue their lives as transgender and pursue gender transition or not, whatever that means to them, if that answers your question. Has anybody seen anything different than that in those cases?
Can sometimes get muddy during the teenage years because of the increasing quote-unquote popularity of non-binary identities. And so the child who was certain, that the assigned female at birth child who was certain at 12 that he was male may in later teen years identify as non-binary.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think as we develop more and more language, right, and alternative ways to exist and be in the world, and more acceptance as it comes within society, I think that there will be changes around transition. I think potentially people may not, you know, pursue medical transition as much if our society, will there be people that are part of a gender binary that, you know, transition and see themselves going from female to male, male to female? Absolutely. I think that will always exist. Absolutely. It's a part of identity and existence and human just diversity. And I think potentially as we become broader in our understanding of gender and our identities, I think that there might be a decrease that people can fully actualize themselves with having different types of bodies and different identities. Did someone have somebody?
I worked with a youth, a teenager. I think they were either 14 or 15. And part of the reason they came into therapy was because of gender identity, and they had they were assigned female at birth, and they were identifying as male, had adopted a name, clothing styles, a lot of those things, being very strident about it, and then totally flipped on that, which was they did that a few months after I stopped seeing them. They just decided to not come to therapy. And I think that for some of us who work, there's a couple of us, I'm with some of my teammates here, in community mental health, where there's a lot of other issues, that the mental health crossover with sort of identity issues can get really murky in how to support those families, because this person has completely gone back to identifying as female 100% after having this very big dramatic sweep. But it's one of those cases where it puts into question how to support the families through things that are sort of co-mingling of mental health issues and identity in adolescence, and how it can how it can show up in treatment.
So I'm not going to read this, but just a good resource, Jean Maupas. If you are not familiar with him, he's part of the Ackerman Institute Gender Identity Project. Great resource, wonderful person to know about, does a lot for the field, just really, really great work, in my opinion. And basically has coined this statement, and what I use with all parents is acceptance is protection. Acceptance is protection, because we talk about that. And when I'm talking with families, I'm constantly talking about I'm behind on slides here. We're gonna keep moving. Basically, when I'm talking with families, I'm talking about safety and I'm talking about respect, because no matter what, that's what all folks want for their kids, right? No matter what, that can't be argued. So again, acceptance is protection. Another great resource to know about is Diane Ehrensaft. She has a couple different books. There's the Gender Creative Child, Gender Born, Gender Made. Just really important to know about. She talks about the core sense of self and a false self, which we don't have time to get into. But some really great work there, just to, in terms of looking into. So Diane Ehrensaft, another great resource. So ultimately, we're following the child's lead, right? Part of the question is, as therapists, is what are we afraid of, right? And I'd love to have conversation around this. We don't have a whole lot of time. But what are we afraid of?
Amongst other, amongst a lot of things, we're afraid that we'll get it wrong with a cisgender child. And what value do we place on that over the real needs of transgender youth?
Anyone else? What are we afraid of?
At this particular moment, recommending hormones and top surgery for a 16-year-old. And as confident as I am now in their confidence in their gender, what if?
Absolutely.
I can also shout.
Okay, that's great. Yes.
Who is, I think, the director at Callen Lord. And in her experience, she has not heard of one lawsuit, and she has lots of experience in the field, 25 years. But I just find for myself, even with that knowledge, there's still the liability and risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think part of the conversation is that we're doing the best we can, right? And so we're meeting kids where they are. And part of it, I think less of it is about future versus present tense. The kids have a very strong sense of who they are in the present moment, and ultimately that's all we have, and that's where we're meeting them. So in terms of letters, same thing, I have not heard of any sort of liability issues, but there is this fear, and it's very valid, it's very real, and yet there's been little to no cases in which it's been an issue. I have a lot of things to say and not enough time. We're going to keep moving. Just, I'll hold. I'm going to keep going. So there's different options. There's reversible interventions. There's partially reversible interventions. There's irreversible interventions, so gender confirmation surgeries. There's cross-sex hormone therapy, psychotherapy as needed. Again, it's not a requirement. Social transition, pubertal blockers. Oh, I don't have time. Another great resource, I work closely with Dr. Carolyn Wolf Gould of the Gender Wellness Center in Oneonta, New York. It's a center of excellence now. It's in a rural location. You know, she has some really great thoughts. I'm not going to go through and read that. But I think, you know, if you're looking for additional resources, she's a great person to know as well. I'm going to keep moving. I think another thing is few people who transition regret it. And I wonder over time if this is going to change. I don't know. There's lots of controversy and conversations about this informed consent models. And I'll just sort of see that conversation, that it exists, that there could potentially in time be people who do have regret. And I think that comes down to the liability. We have concerns, and in the moment we're doing the best that we possibly can to meet people where they are. And we can't necessarily know or have a prediction of the outcome in the future. I kind of joke with parents, you know, wouldn't it be nice if, joking of course, if we had a litmus test, you know, pee on the stick and, you know, here, your kid is definitely this and do this, this, and this, and they'll be great and healthy and safe forever. You know, we just don't have that, unfortunately, when it comes to gender. So again, Diane Arensaf talks about that false sense of self. And so the benefit of early transition is that youth do not have that false sense of self, right? That they get to live their true authentic identity, right? That socialization would happen naturally and ultimately during the proper life cycle stage. Okay. I know I'm going fast through these. These are all available through WPATH, which, again, I understand has its limitations as well. But currently, these are the guidelines that we follow. But you can find those online. So Standards of Care 7 is a PDF available. So I'm not going to read through those. So this is the main point I want to make on this slide. Allowing puberty to progress in teens assigned or natal gender is not a neutral option. It is not a neutral option. So often I hear parents say, well, why don't we just wait until they go into puberty? You know, then we'll have a better sense. Let's wait until they're 18, until they're older, and they can make decisions for themselves. Parents and caregivers have a lot of pressure on them, you know, from society at large, from other parents, from community, from schools, from the child themselves. There's a lot at play. And I just appreciate this quote. It's remembered that giving but also withholding endocrine treatment is a momentous and responsible decision. One cannot sidestep the ethical dilemmas by merely avoiding them, especially given the devastating impact puberty can have on this population. Okay. So again, the question becomes, so what is the ethical impact of not assisting these young people? And we don't have time to get into that, unfortunately, but, you know, what is the ethical impact of not assisting folks with transition, whether it's social transition, medical transition, if that's, you know, a part of their experience. Yeah. So I don't have time to go over all of these, but there's so many different, the point is advocacy. Advocacy is needed in schools. There's so many different issues that occur for folks that are trans and non-binary, so that we have to be looking at all these areas. And I'm happy to share these slides because I know that I'm sort of going through it. But I hope our rich conversation was worth it, despite. And I just love this quote. Parents have little influence over their children's gender identity, but extensive influence over their children's gender health. Again, that's Diane Arensaft. Right? I think that's a huge point. Another great resource to know about is Caitlin Ryan with the Family Acceptance Project. So encourage you to kind of look into that. She's got some great research, really worth looking into in terms of accepting parents and the importance of acceptance for kids, etc. Again, for the sake of it, this is all available. Family Acceptance Project, if you look into Caitlin Ryan's work, you can find all this stuff. I borrowed that from her. Again, you can find that with her. I know we're rushing through this. So again, the main concern I find across the board with parents is, and regardless of what the parents' reactions are, whether they're super accepting or they're terrified, or fear is the consistent factor that I find with all families, regardless of how they respond. How is my kid going to be okay in the world? How are they going to find love? Are they going to be able to get a job? Are they going to go to school or college? Are they going to be bullied? Are they going to be harassed? Are they going to be murdered? How is my kid going to be okay in this world that doesn't make space for them? Yet, I hope. Right? Okay. And these are questions that come up a lot. You know, not accepting enough and inflict more suffering. Too accepting and expose my child to violence. Again, there's so many other factors that influence. And folks are coming in. So again, when we're working with folks, we're talking about loss of expectations, narrative, dreams, and reshaping that, right? So, and moving to a place of celebrating diversity, celebrating trans identities. I think that's part of our issue, is that we're not there yet. So I think as we move towards that, that's better. At large. And I guess we'll end with this. So regardless of whether a gender nonconforming child transitions socially or medically, it's in the best interest of all children expressing gender nonconformity to have their authentic expressions of gender supported by peers, parents, teachers, and other adults in their lives. I feel like that goes without saying. So again, I'll make these slides available. I apologize we had to rush at the end, but I appreciate the conversation. It was very rich and deep. And I thank all of you, and thank you for all the work that you do with folks. It's critical work that we do, so thank you.
Okay, we're at the final stretch. We just want to pull people in if they're in the lobby to summarize our experience today. Thank you all for spending the day with us. And I think there's some people from the other building that are probably making their way over here, but we'll incorporate them in as they come. Just want to offer us a summary of the day, some of the main points, and then ask those of you who were at workshops who might have one takeaway to share. Maybe we could have somebody with a mic for the takeaways. So starting with where we began this morning with two wonderful keynote talks. I just want to summarize some of the takeaways that I took and share with you just as a reminder to call us all back into where we started today and where we ended up. I just really appreciated the statement, the personal is political and professional. We then explored the concept of intersection of sexuality, gender, and sexual orientation. We learned new terms, all sorts of them. But the overriding message with the new terms is the need to ask each person what a particular term means to them. We talked about intersectionality, the various ways that people can become marginalized, and how they may be dealing with more than one sense of marginalization. We reviewed the history of civil rights and how marginalization impacts mental health. And then we took a harder look at gender and began to look outside the usual binary boxes with AC. We explored kinds of gender identity along with the array of terminology. We explored gender expression. We talked about scrubbing assumptions and talked about how to be respectful. We then all together dove into a complex case. And we thought through as a group, each table, and then the presenters, how we would approach that case. Then we all went off to lunch, hopefully had some good conversations over lunch. But then there were six different workshops this afternoon, and I'd like to invite one person from each workshop to just share a takeaway so that we can all benefit from the bigger conversation. So somebody that attended Changing the Narrative, Paving the Way Toward Resilience, can we get a hand of somebody to share a takeaway? I didn't attend it, so I can't be the one. Anybody attend Sydney's workshop? Nobody? Yes, yes. Did you? Okay, could you share one takeaway, Stephanie?
Oh gosh, I'm kind of just decompressing from mine. The takeaway is certainly with all of the research and the need for family support for the large umbrella of trans youth and the need for family support and what a impact, and also I think the biggest takeaway is to be really careful about the narrative. That it doesn't have to be a tragic narrative, a worrisome narrative. That was my takeaway.
Wonderful. Great. What about Julie Mencher's workshop on therapist discomfort and use of self with trans and gender diverse clients? Is there anybody who attended that that'd be willing to share one takeaway? I know we're all tired, but okay, here we go.
I mean, I think just my biggest takeaway was that awareness of our feelings is critical and that using our reactions in our work is necessary. And I'm also sort of taking this as an opportunity to say that I hope that we're all committed to continuing our learning and that if folks are running into blind spots today, that they're getting additional supervision and consultation and finding folks to consult with, because I think this is a really long and ongoing learning process, especially for those of us who don't share identities with our clients, and that's sort of a takeaway from that session and also just a general hope.
Thank you. How about somebody that went to Orienting the Strengths and Challenges of Relational Therapy with Joe Wynn? Did anybody attend that? Anybody willing to share a takeaway? Nobody. Okay, can you get the, could you wait for the mic?
So I think that one of the takeaways, I think, from that one was and really kind of getting to know what the fears are behind or the kind of the needs behind people's kind of queries for what their, you know, kind of sexual or relationship or romantic or emotional needs are, not just kind of assuming, and really to kind of queer the way that you hold your frame for relationships and both sexual and romantic, and even with, especially with couples who identify as heterosexual or have heteronormative relationships, to kind of queer the frame, especially around like consent and getting to know what does pleasure mean, what does sex mean to you, and really kind of bringing in these ideas to kind of assist when working with couples or triads or polycules.
Thank you. For those of you who are just walking in, we're asking for one takeaway from each of the workshops. So what about A.C. Mercer's workshop on supporting families with gender diverse youth? I know a number of you in the room here were in attendance. Can somebody share a takeaway? Here we go. Wait for the mic.
I feel like I took away that there's so much emerging data and research around gender diverse youth, but what we know for sure is that support, acceptance, and affirming our youth cannot hurt, and there's never going to be research that says it will, right? So, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, and did somebody here attend Stephanie Brandenburg's working with LGBTQ relationships? Okay, Jason?
Yeah, one of the takeaways from her case presentations was the importance and really the necessity of understanding how homonegativity and homophobia manifest in the clinical formulations of the in the couple's context, and how important it is to explore and deconstruct those things within the couple's narrative as well.
Thank you. And finally, the last workshop was with Jane Fleischman, Stonewall at 50, Queering the Lens on Aging and Sex. Is there somebody who attended that who can give us a one takeaway?
there are three mics heading in my direction, and I need none of them. So it was really cool being in a room full of folks who have gone through numerous levels of oppression due to sexual orientation, and being negative 15 years old when Stonewall happened, and really listening to a lot of the stories and the camaraderie that existed, and being able to share some of the strengths, some of the resilience that Jane is so beautifully gathered together in her research and her dissertation and the book that she's written. It was a really, really cool experience. So thank you, Jane, for getting that together and for the others that shared their experience.
Okay, I'd like to just ask the presenters to come up to the front as we end today to just get one more round of applause for your participation. This was an incredible group of presenters, and I want to appreciate every single one of them for sharing all of your knowledge and your personal stories. I think Julie and Jane are somewhere, but anyway, they're somewhere around here. I'll relay this to them. Jane's coming. All right. So just please give this group a great round of applause. And thank you all for participating in this unique program. It's been a pleasure to meet with all of you and to have you participate.
And last but not least, I'd like to thank Nancy for conceptualizing this, putting all the work together for about 9 or 10 months to bring this together, and for all of you for participating and really sharing.
Thank you. Please fill out your day-long evaluations and then bring them up to the front desk for CEs if you're hoping to get them, if you've prepaid them. No, you're going to get an instruction sheet or an actual certificate.